Blog Talk Radio.
It is Monday, March 18th, and this is NCEBC Blog Talk Radio. Our guest today is Dr. Adelaide Sanford. Our co-host is Dr. Nicole McZeal-Walters, Professor, University of St. Thomas at Houston. How are you, Nicole?
I'm doing great, Eric. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. Looking forward to this week. Have to travel down to Birmingham, Alabama for a presentation at the Rotary Club of Birmingham tomorrow. So I'm really looking forward to getting to a great state.
We will be sending very good vibes, positive vibes your way. I know that you will knock it out of the park like you always do.
I hope so. Thank you for your good wishes. NCEBC Blog Talk Radio is partially funded this month by Pearson Education. You can visit Pearson at pearsoned.com. NCEBC Blog Talk Radio is a service, a labor of love, if you will, provided by the National Council on Educating Black Children and the National Urban Alliance for Effective Education. Our goal is to bring the best of research, advocacy, knowledge, instruction, and policy, which is beneficial for improving the lives of black and brown students. We know, we've learned, not only from Congressman Augustus Hawkins, the late great Congressman Augustus Hawkins, that children of color are proxy for what ails public education. By improving their lives, we improve the life trajectories for all children. So listeners, welcome. Please remember you can call in at any time to pose a question at 714-242-5228. Again, that is 714-242-5228. Again, our guest today, we're excited, our guest today, because she's a veritable heroine in my eyes. I really do look up to her, genuflect to her whenever I can, because she's lived a storied life, a storied career. Energetic, youthful, ready to march at any moment, ready to march on behalf of children in particular. She's the kind of educational leader that we need more of in this country. So many of you, I hope, will learn from the words of wisdom that Dr. Adelaide Sanford, who is former Chancellor Emerita of the New York State Board of Regents in New York. Adelaide has taught in elementary schools, has been a principal of the Christus Abbott School in Brooklyn, New York, and received a doctorate from Fordham University. She is the recipient of numerous honors, too numerous to list, but they include the Congressional Black Caucus Foundation's Humanitarian Award and Distinguished Alumni Awards from Wellesley and Brooklyn College. She is a consummate advocate for improving the lives of black and brown students. Dr. Sanford, we welcome you to NCEBC Blog Talk Radio.
Thank you. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Honored to have you here. You know, we know that every year there is a commemoration in Selma where people march across the Edwin Pettus Bridge.
Yes.
You march every year. Tell us about that.
The Jubilee, the Bridge Crossing Jubilee, is held in Selma, Alabama, on the first Sunday in March of each year. And that Jubilee is an educational experience with workshops and forums and speakers, but it is also the reenactment of that walk across that bridge where our people were brutalized, beaten, humiliated, and some killed in an effort to secure the right to vote. And it was the beginning of the movement toward the Voting Rights Act. So I feel that in order for us to remember the nature of the struggle, the sacrifices, and also the strategies of the struggle, we must relive these kinds of historic events to keep ourselves aware of the power of the potent remnant, the small group of people in terms of numbers who made the tremendous effort and sacrifice, many whose names we will never know, and some whose names we do know. So I have been going to the Bridge Crossing Jubilee approximately 7 or 8 years. And each year that I go, I am more inspired to understand that unless we're able to give our children of today, who are so removed from the struggle, who do not know the history, who have not had the opportunity to visit sites like that, or even to visit any of the remnants that are still across the South and a few in the Northeast that tell our story, until we're able to capture the significance of having our children experience this, they will never be able to understand what their role is.
Well, you know, I mean, that just brings to mind the fact that the past is often prologued. And I think what you are highlighting for us is the importance for us to remember our history in a way that leads to contemporary activity. Especially important, don't you think, Adelaide, when you think about how some states are attacking voting rights?
Absolutely. So that we understand that it is never over, that we each generation has a freedom struggle. Today they say that education is today's civil rights movement. But when you look at that statement, it gives you the impression that everybody's going to come together and deliver civil rights to you. But civil rights is an issue of people who do not have rights. It is not an issue for people who have rights and make the laws to make sure that their rights continue. So if this is today a civil rights movement for education, then we have to take ownership of that. And I think the only way we can take ownership of it is to first to know the history of the struggles for voting rights, for public transportation, for public accommodations, and what went into making these things happen, or else we will not be able to really have an education that is liberating for our children.
But what do you say to the people who say that we have entered a post-racial society in America?
Well, I think it's a fantasy like Cinderella and Little Bo Peep. It is so totally opposite of the reality. I hear people refer to that, but I've never heard any clear, concise, intelligent description of why you could possibly feel that way when the majority of people in any pathological description, if it's disease, if it's homelessness, if it's dropping out, if it's the prison population, if it's poor housing, it all indicates that they're people of African ancestry. So how can you possibly think that it's post-racial? I haven't heard an intelligent understanding of that.
And when you see discrimination still in housing, in transportation, in jobs, and in education, when you see a country that has gone from working toward integration and successful in some circumstances to where we are now back in resegregated circumstances for our kids, not saying that you can't educate kids in any environment, I think it does belie those who state that this is now a post-racial environment, and mostly they point to our good President Obama as the reason. If we can elect him not once but twice, then we have to be post-racial. And if we're post-racial, is affirmative action still necessary? If we're post-racial, do we really have to worry about the needs of one group versus another? And I pose that as a question to you.
Well, I think that the people who can say it's post-racial because you've elected a black president twice, a president of African ancestry twice, are looking at one insignificant item in a long list of what would constitute post-racial. If you're talking about post-racial, then you cannot just talk about the election of one person. You have to talk about the totality of the circumstances under which people are living and what kinds of differences have resulted because of that. And when you look at the resistance of many people in the far right in terms of really giving respect, just minimal respect to this president that has been elected. You certainly couldn't think that it's post-racial. So I think that we need to take very lightly just one descriptor of the election twice of a person of African ancestry as an indication of post-racial. You can't just take that one factor.
It is a step, as you agree, but it's not the panacea that people are looking for.
No, and there will be no panacea. And I think that that's one of the reasons that I go back to Selma every year to remind myself of the fact that there is no panacea, and that if we are actually going to have an education that's liberating for our people, then it's the civil rights movement toward education, then it is our movement. And other people of goodwill may join, but we are the ones who will have to take the whole essence of what it means to be an educated person, not beyond schooling.
Education, so racism can both be overt, but it can be covert, where it's been so internalized by our society that we're in shock when we realize how some people have internalized and are not even aware of the residual effects of racism. Is that what you're saying?
I think that's true, and I think that sometimes it's so uncomfortable to face it. There are residual effects. I mean, when you have had 400 years with only one voice speaking about your savagery and your lack of having experiences that relate to culture, no art, no music, no science, no God worship. When you hear that over 400 years, that's all you hear, and then it's followed by all kinds of structures that are put in place to continue to make you feel inferior, from the time of Agassiz and Toynbee all the way down to the fact that it was just after freedom came, and I think it's important to know that this conference was held in Woodstock, and Ray Winbush at Morgan State does a very interesting piece talking about the decisions that were made about how to educate people of African ancestry. And if you look at the results of that Woodstock conference, you will find that's exactly what's happening today. Don't let the children know their history. Never let them connect with the continent of Africa. Teach the teachers not to teach accurate history about the world. This is what they decided. And that's exactly what's happening today. Albert Shanker, in 1987, said just about the same thing. Children of African ancestry must not learn their history because they will identify with their ethnicity instead of being Americans. So consistent from the time we were not allowed to learn to read or write, following all of the philosophical foundations of Agassiz and Toynbee and Hegel and the Coleman Report and the bell curve, into this whole notion of what happens just after freedom with the Woodstock Convention. And then you look at Albert Shanker and what he said and what he was able to enforce. And you look at the resistance to curriculum, even where we have so-called integration. Very often, it's simply two groups of children sitting beside each other, but there's not necessarily an integration of curriculum. There's not necessarily an integration of textbooks,
right?
An integration of materials of instruction. So then when we look at what happened with our children, and we look at Soweto from the time of Soweto, and we look at what happened with the Little Rock Nine, and when we look at what happened with the four little girls in Birmingham, and when we look at what happened with open enrollment in New York, the children who were sent to underutilized schools but were made the floor monitors and the blackboard monitors. And then we look at the whole notion of the busing, that it was always children of African ancestry who were bused. They didn't bus European children. Well, when you put the pieces of this together, you couldn't possibly feel that we have finished. We haven't. We have really not had a full grasp of the enormity of what we must do. And that's why I go to Selma.
I'm always confounded by the fact that people see culture responsive teaching, or the recognition of history, the recognition of ancient history and the impact that Africa has had on the world, as mutually exclusive from what we need to do to help children in America gain a good American education. They're not mutually exclusive. What you're basically saying is that they're two sides of the same coin. By recognizing the history of a people, by looking at culture as a strength, that's what I believe you're saying, Dr. Stanford, by looking at culture as a strength, as something to build on for our children, all children then are created a solid foundation that enables them to succeed. I want to take this brief moment to remind our listeners that you can call in at 714-242-5228 if you have a question or a comment that you would like to pose to the I would call her the famous Dr. Adelaide Sanford, Vice Chancellor Emerita of the New York State Board of Regents. Nicole, do we have any questions yet?
We do have a question, Eric, and this has been, you know, the comments that I've been receiving is that this is just such rich history that, you know, Dr. Sanford, if you have not taped some of this oral history that you've just been giving me and Eric and listeners, please consider doing so, because we're really educating our listeners. I'm being educated as a teacher of graduate students. But one of the questions was, how do we continue to, are we a part of that myth of talking about the race, the post-racial era? You know, you and Eric kind of talked about that, but now that we've elected President Obama for a second term, are we, people of color, are we a part of that? Do we promote that as well?
I think that there may be some people who believe that because, unfortunately, they have not been taught to think critically and analytically. That's not a part of the instructional programs in most public education in America. So therefore, they tend to grasp onto myths that are comfortable. I think in addition to that, to go back to the former discussion about culture, there are no people who believe that culture is not important. European people have pushed their culture from the very beginning of education. So if we look at that from pre-K all the way through, that's their culture that they're pushing. Their classics, their art, their music, their myths, their legends, their stories of power, that's their culture. So how could we possibly believe that people learn well outside of a cultural context?
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
That's not possible. So I think that we can be seduced into thinking that these things are mutually exclusive, but they are not mutually exclusive, and there is nothing by record that helps us to believe that, except the propaganda of feeling that it's not that culture is irrelevant, but it's that you're only supposed to learn about one culture, and that's Western culture.
That's a great segue in terms of us talking about culture to a broader question. Why hasn't education been a liberating and an equalizing factor for African Americans in this country as of yet? We know that there are some strong narratives of success all across the country. We're not delimiting that. But there is a segment of we who are African American who are not succeeding at large numbers. So why hasn't education been a liberating and an equalizing factor for African Americans in particular, Dr. Sanford?
One of the main reasons is because we do not have constitutionally the right to an appropriate education. We don't have it, just like we didn't have voting rights. We didn't have rights to public transportation. We didn't have rights to public accommodation. It was only when we fought, sacrificed, bled, and died for those rights that we secured them, and then we have to struggle to keep those rights active. Therefore, if today we understand that education is a state rights issue, we do not have any federal legislation to which we can go for adjudication if the education is not appropriate. For example, if you take New York State, where I served for 21 years on that state board. We licensed almost 52 professions: landscape designing, nursing, optometry. But education was not considered a profession in that context. So that if the landscape gardener put the pot in the wrong place, or if the wall fell down in your interior design, you could call and say, look, you have violated the professionalism of your work. But if your child never had a full day of school, 10 years in my former school, the children went to school on a half day. You had no adjudicative process. If you never had a certified teacher, if you didn't have textbooks, if you didn't have globes, if you didn't have maps, there was no adjudicative process. That's why education has not been the liberating force, because we do not have a constitutional right to a free, appropriate education that liberates the people that were enslaved by this government. We haven't gotten that. And inasmuch as education is a state rights issue, it means that each state has the prerogative to develop a curriculum and a modality for teacher certification that suits their needs. If voting were a state rights issue, and we could see that when it happened in this last election, when individual states were able to make certain restrictions in terms of voting, but they couldn't say you couldn't vote. They could just make it more difficult. So I think that one of the reasons it hasn't been liberated, we don't have a structure. We have never had a statement that said Agassiz and Toynbee were wrong. We've never had a statement that said what is the result of years of children and their parents not being able to read or write. What does it mean when Brown versus the Topeka Board of Education, that the states in the South say, well, we'll just close the schools? Because it's states' rights. So unless we understand the structure, then we don't know why we don't have an education that's liberating.
So the structural impediments that you just prolifically stated are there. Are you optimistic that we can find answers to solving some of these riddles?
Yes, I'm optimistic if we use the opportunities that exist today. Sometimes we don't know what the opportunities are today. We don't know what the research is that helps us to understand the role that we must play. For example, in the Department of Education, the Federal Department of Education, there is concern about civil rights violations in education. About 4 years ago, 3 years ago perhaps it was, Duncan, Secretary Duncan, at Selma, at Jubilee, said, I am interested in violations in education of civil rights. Now, a year or so ago, President Obama appointed a person to direct that office. A group of us with our congressperson met with her, Ruslan Ali, in Brooklyn, New York, about 2 years ago, and she indicated that that office has always existed from through the Bush and Clinton administration, but it was never active. Now there was the desire for it to be active. The difficulty is it is for us to define what a civil rights violation is. At the present time, when we spoke to the director, Dr. Ali, she said that they had more than 700 complaints that they were working on, most of them related to the overrepresentation of African-American boys in terms of suspensions. The other related to the lack of the availability of translated information to parents from people who spoke other languages. That's fine, but what about our ability to define a civil rights violation? And one of the things that Russell and Ali said, she said, even if we don't win, we will investigate a complaint that's made. Now, I would think that knowing that the federal government was responsible for the loss of the ability of people of African ancestry to learn their history, that there may be a civil rights violation in that with a good group of civil rights lawyers in education. It is up to us to define. Somebody else can't define what a civil rights violation in education is. They may help, but it's up to us to define that, to say that if our children do not have teachers who respect them and who understand what their life has been and the life of their ancestors has been, and do not understand the role of Africa in terms of the availability of building up Europe. The money, the uranium, the diamonds, and all of that, if they don't understand that, it's very difficult for them to really value and respect these children. Now, I'm saying that I'm optimistic because of that office. I'm optimistic because of the report that has just been published. I think it was done in California in reference to the role of schools and pupil failure. Now, for years we talked about pupil failure, but we didn't talk about school failure. But this recent report talks about the fact that schools are responsible for the failure of the children. And I think that Chris Edley was the person who chaired
right.
that particular effort. And then there's this wonderful report that came out of the University of Pittsburgh and Harvard, Hughley, Wand and Hughley, and they talk about if parents of African ancestry can give their pupils, their children, racial socialization. Now, that means not just a sense of the history of our people, but it's also a sense of how you straddle these two worlds, how you deal. And the report is very clear in saying that teachers discourage our children's growth and intellect. We know that years ago Geneva Gay, in her studies, indicated that teachers will ask a European student higher thinking skills question and wait longer for the answer. Now, in this last report that I have just cited, when they talk about what parents can do, they also talk about what teachers and schools have done to discourage the intellectual genius of our children. Now, these reports, these two that I've cited, and also the fact of the Office of Civil Rights and Education, I'm optimistic that change can come about. It's a question of getting the information to our people. And it doesn't take everybody. Sometimes we get discouraged because the numbers are small. It takes a potent remnant. What you're doing, small group of you from National Council, and you're putting this information out there so people will. Parents need to know that if they feel that their child's civil rights has been violated, then they have a channel of appeal. It's the only one we have. Most states don't have one, and there's none in the federal government. But in the Federal Office of Education, there is an office that deals with civil rights violations in education, and it's up to us to define what they are.
Well, I think you've just given us some solutions, some pathways for people to consider. The path is littered, obviously, with lots of efforts of parents and teachers and, you know, learners, in fact, who have sought some remedy and have become frustrated within that particular process. But I think what you're saying is we need to have both a broader look, you know, such as what the National Council on Educating Black Children has done in terms of its blueprint for action, which provides not only remedies, but solutions and processes for us to implement, as well as the numerous efforts that are out there. And I got to say, Adelaide, that I am really heartened by the fact that we're now implementing in a majority of the states the Common Core State Standards, because it does demand higher order thinking for all students. My question and my fear is, are we training, providing sufficient professional development for teachers, for principals, to recognize that within those Common Core standards, you still need to be responsive for the children that you're serving, so that they are viewed in terms of what strengths they manifest in that learning circumstances versus the deficits that some people may be looking for. So I think what you're saying is, let's look at those strengths. Let's follow those strengths. And I think one thing that you and I were talking about before we started, and I want to go there now, and I want to, refer our listeners to the call-in number, which is 714-242-5228, 714-242-5228. And our co-host, Nicole, is waiting to handle your questions so that you can ask these things directly on air. But where I was going, Adelaide, was you and I talked off air about the importance of sustainable leadership that really does create that opportunity for the kind of long-term change that we're looking for. And you use the example of the school that you were a principal for 28 years, is that correct?
I was there for 28 years. I was the principal for about 18 of those 28 years because I started there as a teacher. I started there as a teacher in a school that was on a half day and serviced the children in a low-income housing project. That's where I started in 1956. I became principal in the 60s, in the early 60s, and one of the first things that we did was to get a wing for the school so that the children could go to school all day. That was a civil rights violation. We could not put on the children's record card that they had only had a half day of school. So they went into the middle school without having the educational background that they needed, but we couldn't put that on the record card. So it appeared as though it was the children's fault that they didn't know the information that they should have known. Now, as far as I'm concerned, the only way we could change the dynamics in that school, we had to change fundamental issues. One issue was we had to have a school that was big enough for the children to go all day. So we didn't start with reading and math. We started with a building, petitioning the mayor and the governor to allow us to have a wing on this building, which was so new, because the children couldn't go to school all day, and they were in an annex down the street, and they were in temporary housing. But we had to get the parents to understand their role in making that possible, and that's why it took so long.
So what you were doing during that period was recognizing that increasing the hours of engaged academic learning time for children is really critical, correct?
Absolutely, and that there would be no way for us to allow our children to continue to be on a half day and to go into the middle school without the information base that they needed,
yeah.
And therefore it would affect their history in school all along.
So part of the engaged learning time, this is where I want to go with this particular question to you. KIPP schools, for instance, are seeing success in many of their schools primarily because they have administrated a longer day, a longer school day for their kids. Now, from my perspective, if you add to the time that kids are studying in their classrooms with their teachers in their schools, and you extend that to 5 o'clock versus the time that we dismiss kids now, of course you're going to see increased achievement. Wouldn't you agree with that?
There is very, very clear indication that children need more time in school. Hopefully, those extended hours will be productive hours, and
right.
They will be hours that will give the children the kind of enrichment. So
right.
I KIPP school do well for a variety of reasons. They also get a lot of support from the federal government, and
right.
I think that that has to be a factor in consideration. But I think that we cannot allow ourselves as African Americans to believe that it is only a math and reading score that determines whether a child has been adequately prepared. Without
Amen.
The cultural sense of who they are, of their capabilities, a validation of their worth, a validation of their history, a validation of the continent of Africa that they came from, then they may be able to read and write very well. It will not necessarily be used for the elevation of our people.
And by remembering that history, by having a sense of the genius that exists within you because of those who have walked prior to you living, by recognizing that and building on that, you then can help them extend this renewed and improved self-concept in a manner that it enables them to really see the applications of this knowledge, of this history, in their real world, in their real time.
Exactly. And I think that we have to understand that a part of the proliferation of failure relates to the prison system. Now, when Parchman, major prison in Mississippi, first came into existence, it was right after slavery, and the Europeans did not want the competition of black male labor. And that's why prison Parchman, and it's a very interesting story in the book called Parchman, and Parchman still exists. So all kinds of situations were created, such as public loitering. So if you stand together on the corner and you're talking and trying to look for your lost relatives, you are breaking the law and you can be put in prison. Or if you can't work and you manage to get a piece of ham and you can't have a receipt for it, you're in prison. So there were creations of conditions that forced men of African ancestry into the prison system so that they would not be competition. Now, when you look today at many states that look at the fourth grade reading scores of children to determine how many prison cells to build, I'm sure that you're familiar with that. And in New York City, if you match the areas where schools are failing, you match the areas that the population in the prisons of New York State come from. They fit like a hand in a glove. Well, if we don't understand that, and if we don't understand that if children are failing academically, I'm not just talking about culture now, and they're failing because the school is not supplying the kind of education that motivates them, that makes them feel connected to the school, then you have a perpetuation of a cycle of, well, let's make sure that they don't succeed. Let's just do the European nursery rhymes. Let's not talk about power and strength. Let's not talk about the richness of Europe based on Africa. Let's not talk about the blacks who built the capital. Let's not talk about all of the creative things. And therefore, these children will fail. And then you have a prison that is overpopulated. So I think that all of that goes together to help us to understand that these things are not incidental. It's not just not a happening. They're very carefully crafted.
Mm-hmm.
They're very carefully strategized. And I think that one of the reasons that there is an elder's house in Selma, Alabama, is because 3 years ago, Mrs. Winnie Mandela was given recognition in Selma. And when she spoke, I looked at this gentle, very beautiful, peaceful-looking woman, and I thought about all she had gone through in her life. And here she was, radiant, positive. And I began to hear Makeda and Yah Sattawar and Hatshepsut and Isis and Septima Clark and Isiola McCarthy. I began to see and hear them in the words of Mrs. Mandela. And one of the things that she said was, Selma should have history of all of the efforts for civil rights in America, not just the voting rights, which has been beautifully preserved, and what they did when they burned down the houses that people of African ancestry lived in, the whole tent city story that's there. They have kept that so alive. And I thought to myself, what if we had a building that contained the history of the efforts toward an appropriate education, that told about Septima Clark, that told about Osceola McCarthy, because that was a civil rights movement. Open enrollment was. That told about the efforts that ASA made. That told about the freedom school. That told about the church school. To captivate for our children an understanding of the children's role in the civil rights movement. Our children don't know anything about that. They don't know anything about what happened with the four little girls in Birmingham, even during Black History Month. You're not allowed to talk about that part.
Right. I think what you're talking about, what's coming to my mind right now, Adelaide, is the fact that Ubuntu, I am because we are.
Yes.
I am because we are. You know, Ubuntu.
Yes.
And I think what is critical here is when people have said to me in criticism of my using that African proverb, they would say, but that's not true, Dr. Cooper. I am because I am. Now, what I've tried to explain to those who would criticize, they're lacking a deep understanding of the importance of history, that you are because we are. You are because others have sacrificed their lives for you. And your strength as an individual for you to be able to say, I am because I am, is because we have come together as a people, as leaders, to create opportunities that enabled you to grow and to exist. And I think what you're talking about with the elder's house is so important. It's so important, and it could happen in every community in America where we would have a house that could be used as a cultural repository, not just a museum, but a way for tracking the contributions that many have sacrificed over the years for us to be able to internalize so that we think more highly of ourselves as a people, as part of a great nation. That's where you're going with this.
Yes, and I think that if you understand the importance of that particular proverb, you will understand that people of African ancestry are a cumulative, cooperative people. And if you walk across that bridge, you will understand that no individual could have done what happened on that bridge had they not gone there together. It would never have happened. And why don't we just send one diplomat to solve the problems of the world? We send a whole army. So this whole notion of I am because I am doesn't have any basis in history. It may be used to make us feel, as people of African ancestry, that there's something dangerous about our coming together. Because other people do not feel that they are individuals. So I think that ability to analyze and to understand a basic concept in the African cultural sense, responsibility for the children, respect for the elders, and understanding that we are a cooperative people. We are a collective, and we function best in a collective capacity. This individualism, which is a part of Western thinking, is very damaging if you are nation building.
Very damaging if you are nation building, because it becomes, the goals are focused on one group versus the betterment of all. And I think that's where you're going. Again, I want to remind listeners that there is a call-in number, which is 714-242-5228. You can call in and talk with our guest. We have approximately 18 more minutes left of the show. And I want to remind our listeners that NCEBC Blog Talk Radio is partially funded this month by Pearson Education. You can visit Pearson at pearsoned.com. I can speak for myself as the host, and I can speak for Nicole as well. Adelaide, this is like such an important conversation that needs to be had. You know, we need to have this over and over and over again, so we do not forget.
Multiple times. That's absolutely right. Eric, we do actually have a caller from Atlanta who would like to address Adelaide. Is it okay if I bring her in?
Please do.
Definitely.
Great.
Good morning.
Good morning. This is Terry Ali from Atlanta, Georgia. And Dr. Sanford, you know, I heard you in Cleveland, Ohio, in a HumaDoc conference years ago when I was a mom. And you were so affirming, and I just want, now I'm a grandmother, and actually we are great-grandparents, my husband and I, and I would like you to talk about the role of grandparents in the schools. I think some of the requirements, kind of makes grandparents feel like they don't have much to contribute. And, you know, I'm encouraging grandparents to flood schools for after-school programs and so forth. And even the issue about children staying at school longer, that really alarms me. Because for me, you know, I feel like I don't have enough time to give my grandchildren that history already. I would hate to them. I mean, I really look forward to them coming over after school or weekends or spending some time. So, Dr. Sanford, anything you can give us for grandparents and encouraging grandparents to be involved, because we have so much to give.
The respect for the elders, which is a part of a core concept in African culture, recognizes the significance of the people who are the elders or the grandparents. America is a youth-oriented society. People want to look young. They take away the wrinkles. They take away the gray hair. It's not youth-supported. It's not child-centered, but it is youth-oriented. And so we're in that struggle, and we hear so many people say, oh, I don't talk about my age, which means that they do not understand that as African-Americans, your age is the value time for you to function in a role that is most significant. Many of our grandparents today are quite young. They're still working. They're still trying to fulfill their own dreams and aspirations. And so I think that It is important to have grandparents, and it's important to have elders in the life of children. If they can be grandparents, wonderful. If they're not grandparents, their own biological grandparents, then they can be surrogate grandparents. At my former school, we had a relationship with the Senior Citizens Center, which was very close by, and the people who came to that center came primarily for meals and recreation. They didn't live there. And because our children didn't have grandparents who were old, their grandparents were in their 40s and 50s and still in the working force, and we felt that the children, because of the European nursery rhymes, where people who are old, you know, are decrepit, and there wasn't a sense of respect for old people, we developed that relationship with that Senior Citizen Center, and the children would go there to hear stories, and they would take the stories, and these older people became so connected to the children. So my answer to you, yes, the role of grandparents is important, the lack time, the story time, the non-negotiable love, also the correction and direction that's necessary to give to children so that they do grow up strong. But where there are no biological grandparents, elders should have a meaningful role in the life of children.
The education of our children in our communities is a community endeavor. And each resource that a human being brings to the life of a child is critical. And grandparents, great-grandparents, aunts, uncles, barbers, lawyers, teachers, police officers, all of us have a responsibility in that role. And that's what I'm hearing Dr. Sanford say to us today, listeners. I think it's really critical that as a community, we can enable our children by empowering them, by sharing a knowledge that enables them to grow and to expand and to see the opportunity that exists out there with the courage that comes from a community focus. You know, there are many who have said it takes a village to raise a child. Well, you know, it does take a community, and that community needs to be extended. If we get ourselves locked in to those gated communities, and some of those gated communities exist in Atlanta as well as elsewhere, then we lock ourselves away from the human potential that not only extends our influence in our life through our experiences, but enables that child to become successful in his or her goals, so that the life trajectories are important. And I think what is so critical in terms of the work that you continue to do, Adelaide, and we're so honored and humbled by the experiences and the knowledge base that you bring to this conversation today, that we have to recognize that schools, in terms of this creating school as a building, as a structure, really is a life force. Schools
yes.
are not just mortar and brick. They are a life force that creates an opportunity for centering our attentions. And you've
yes.
started schools in Africa. You have schools named after you. You've worked with Dr. Asa G. Hilliard. You've worked with Dr. John Henry Clark and many other scholars that work tirelessly for us to understand our history, and you have that sense of consciousness to engage our children in intergenerational socialization, as you just so poignantly answered the wonderful question posed to you from the Atlanta, you know, great-grandparent in terms of what she feels is necessary. So, you know, this intergenerational socialization and education, how do we train more leaders to embrace the importance of keeping these elements in mind, consciousness, and the education socialization of our children in front of their actions, whether you're a federal, state, or local elected official education, or if you are a parent. I know parents who've called in, who've talked with me, who are so frustrated by the lack of action or the inaction that happens in terms of being able to solve problems for their children in terms of their placement in various programs. How do we keep this? How do we grow this movement that builds on your rich experience that you're sharing with us today, Dr. Sanford?
It is important for us to keep in mind our capacity. Sometimes we're overwhelmed by what it is that we cannot do. For example, some of the most successful nursery school programs that I have seen are housed in a senior citizen center. Senior citizen center is upstairs, the nursery school is downstairs. And programmed into the activities of both groups are these opportunities of sharing story time and play time and so forth.
What a great structural intervention. That's a great idea.
Well, now, many of our churches have senior citizens programs, feeding programs for senior citizens. They also have nursery school programs in the same school, in the same church, in the same building.
And anyone can do this.
Anyone can do it. And it's so simple. It's a natural on the part of children. And, you know, there's something about African-American children. When you say grandma, something inside of them, I don't know if it's genetic memory or what it is, it brings a sense of tenderness and compassion. Sometimes I ride the trains when I lived in New York. And people would say to me, oh, you're on that train by yourself and somebody's going to do this or that. I said, all I have to do is say, look at them and say, do you have a grandmother? Or you can call me grandma. And there's a change in the expression that comes across their face. There's a tenderness. And we want our children to have a remembrance of older people that brings that forth. So wherever we can, we don't have to look to create everything. But the churches have this possibility. Every year, any kind of sorority or fraternity or social organization or business organization can have, as a part of one of the things that they do, coming together with young children who do not have grandparents. And you can become a surrogate grandparent and have a relationship with children who need to have that extra person in their life. It's not impossible to do.
Because you're defining family not only by the genetic makeup of what creates a family biologically, but you're talking about family in terms of love. That loving human beings can create family. It's not a quasi-family.
Exactly.
It is family.
Well, you know, my grandmother was a chattel slave in this country, by the laws of this country. And I knew her in my lifetime. And she often talked about what happened on that plantation. She was living in the house because she was the daughter of a woman who was sold with her on this plantation in the Carolinas. And even though they arranged for the people in the field not to be able to speak the same language as the people in the house, because the idea of cutting off the communication was very, very dominant. That's why we know communication is so important. But my grandmother said that it didn't matter what these children spoke or where they came from, as long as they were of African ancestry. Whenever they could, they embraced these children. They nurtured them. They touched them with warmth and love until old Miss or old Master came around and they had to pretend that, get on the way out, wait for me, you're in my way, because they knew that if there was evidence of bonding, there would be separation. So here again, on that plantation, in that hellhole in which they lived, they still had the capacity to love, the audacity to love, the ability to, the willingness to love. And the reason for that is that's your humanity. And so my grandmother was loved by any of the women there in that house, as were the other little children of African ancestry. Great if you have a biological parent or grandparent, but that's not the limit. I have loved so many children. I've loved them with my heart of love.
You're bringing us to tears, Dr. Sanford. At least you're bringing me to tears. I mean, you really are. Because we now know from neuroscience that, and what you said was so powerful, the evidence of bonding led to separation during that day. Because when we are bonding, when we have fallen in love, and I just mean fallen in love of an individual so that you recognize that life force as something for you to support, When we bond in that manner, neuroscience has now taught us that, you know, the brain emits things called neurotransmitters called oxytocins, which can speed up the cognitive processing that we know is so necessary and so critical to the kind of higher order thinking skills that you're talking. So what you have just identified is so critical. So say that again to our listeners. Build on that.
Well, my grandfather was born of the relationship between the plantation owner and the African woman. Now, the African woman, who was my grandfather's mother, had a black man that she loved. She couldn't marry him because they were not allowed to marry each other or anybody. But it was that black man who raised my grandfather, gave him what it meant to be a man, to be strong, to be a carpenter, to be courageous, to be strategic. The plantation owner did not give him anything but his name because he wanted him to be counted as his slave. And when I tell young men that I embrace you as a man of African ancestry, because I don't know of any other men who raise the children born of the rape of their wives and loved them and taught them and steered them toward manhood. This is what love is. It transcends boundaries. So this capacity of African-American men that they don't know about, it's not about my baby mama. It's not about how many children you can breed that you won't be a father to. That's what the plantation owner did. He had all these children that he did not take care of. But it was the African man who raised the children born of the rape of their wives.
This is oral history, listeners. This is this is the emotions that we need to tap into so that cognitively we're able to grow and expand our minds. The capacity of our brains is so vast.
Oh,
if we can begin to understand the historical makeup of who we are, not only as people, but as being part of a human race, a race that began in Africa, a race that was expanded culturally, economically by Africa. And what Dr. Stanford has been sharing with us today, I don't know about you listeners, but me, I'm sitting at the edge of my seat in my office in Connecticut, feeling like I'm energized. I know my norepinephrine has been activated, my adrenaline is activated, because she's tapping into that reservoir, that historical reservoir that needs to be made more clear or more visible to all of us, to all people. And it's not just the black or brown races. It is all people who can benefit from this because we are one family. We have come from Africa. So let go of your fears when you open your ears to the words, the brilliant words that have been shared today with you by one of my heroes in life, and that is you, Dr. Stanford.
Oh, thank you.
I could just fall apart and cry. We have one more minute where you might be able to share some other jewels of thought with our listeners before we end our show.
In 2015, the 50th anniversary of the Voting Rights Act will take place. And there will be celebrations in Birmingham and certainly in Selma. And we are hoping that at that time, Eldridge House, which is called A Gift to the Children from the Elders, will be a place that all of the people who walk across that bridge will come to and get some sense of the magnificent, powerful history that tells of our strength and of our effort, and that they will be revitalized to leave there determined to come back often and determined to make sure that we never stop the effort for children of African ancestry to have a liberating, appropriate, culturally valid education, which will include schooling, but it will not be limited to schooling.
When you are able to provide the sustained effort to focus on an outcome or a goal, you are strengthening your not only your brain, but your mind is becoming whole. So 2015, what is the date? Do we have a date for that yet?
The first Sunday in March.
First Sunday in March.
Of every year.
Dr. Stanford, I humbly submit to you that we have been honored to participate in the oral history and the brilliance and the gifts and the talents that you bring to your life. May God continue to bless you. We need him to bless you, primarily because more Dr. Stanfords we can have, the better this world will become. So thank you very much.
I appreciate the opportunity. Love you.
Love you too. We are ending our show. The show is NCEBC Blog Talk Radio. Our executive producer is Diana Daniels. My co-host is Nicole McSeal Waters. And our technical producer and co-producer is Lexa Smith. I am your host, Eric Cooper, of the National Urban Alliance for Effective Education. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye.
Bye-bye.